My name is Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God in the program, the people, and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the group here for asking me to come down here and share with you. It's a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to congratulate the birthday guys, and it's good to see Mike again. It's always a pleasure, Mike. I'd like to welcome the new people. I'm real glad you're here. And I don't want to say that to embarrass you. It's terrible. I was a serial newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous for probably 7 years. I think I was the 12-step practice dummy of Pennsylvania. You know, everybody would come and try to share their experience, strength, and hope with me. And I hated being new. And I hated being a newcomer because they would always make me stand up in a meeting and introduce myself. And it's never a high point in my life when I want to be recognized. I mean, you know, it's not like things are going well and I want attention. I mean, it's not, I feel like I want to crawl under a rock and they want me to stand up and be recognized. I hated coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're new, I got to tell you that you have an opportunity here to latch into something that will do more for you than anything you've ever found in your whole life. And this is the best deal I've ever got. And even though I went to great lengths to resist it for a number of years, something about me that didn't want to be here. I think I was born with alcoholism. I'll tell you a story. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, I was living back in Pennsylvania, and I went with my parents one Sunday afternoon to this farmer's market. And we were going out there for the specific reason of seeing this one farmer who my dad raved about made this special type of horseradish that was hotter and more potent than anybody in the whole part of the country. It's won several awards, and my dad liked stuff like that. He liked the hotter the better. And we're going out there, and he gets this jar of horseradish, and he's telling my mom how great it is. And I'm like 3, 4 years old. I'm listening to all this, and I wanted some. And I asked him for some, and he said, "No, son, you can't have any. This is only for adults. It's too powerful. You're just too young." And I'm one of those kind of guys that I may not really want something that much until you tell me I can't have it, you know. And then you tell me I can't have it, I get real obsessed with getting it. And I bid my time and waited till my folks were visiting the neighbors, and I snuck in that kitchen, went in that refrigerator, got that big jar of horseradish out, got myself a big spoon, sat in the floor of that kitchen, took that lid off that horseradish, stuck that big spoon in there, put that in my mouth. This was before LSD. But I saw some shit that day. Snot's pouring out of my nose and tears are coming down my eyes. I spewed horseradish all over that kitchen. I got so sick. It was unbelievable. And I got to tell you, that was a lot of years ago, and I've never sat with a jar of horseradish and a big spoon once. Didn't have to go to no treatment center, get no sponsor, go to no goddamn meetings or work no steps. But I got to also tell you that if that horseradish would have done for me and made me feel the way alcohol made me feel, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with horseradish every chance I could get. And I believe that I was an alcoholic before I ever picked up a first drink. I was kind of like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol, because I desperately needed to have something done that I didn't even know I needed to have done until I found alcohol. And alcohol did something for me that I think I'd always wanted to have done, didn't even know how to have it done. Prior to ever picking up a first drink, there was something wrong with me. I always had this feeling I don't quite fit. There was nobody in my family, in my neighborhood, and nobody in school that looked the way I felt. I went through life and with the feeling like it was all of you, and then there was me. And I felt separate and apart from. And I had felt that way all the time. And I always felt like I desperately wanted to fit, and I desperately wanted to be like the people around me. And I took my first drink. I was 12 years old, and I'm hanging around with a bunch of older kids. They're the juvenile delinquents in the neighborhood. And I'm doing everything I can to fit, because I desperately want to belong. And I think that if I act like they act, maybe I'll feel like they look, and I never felt like they looked. And one day we pulled this burglary, and one of the things we stole was out of this, somebody's house was a bunch of bottles of whiskey. And we're passing around this quart of Seagram 7. And I have no idea what that whiskey did to any of those other kids, but I took a big hit off that bottle. It burnt like hell, got down inside of me and spread out. And for the first time in my life, I felt like those kids I was hanging around with. For the first time in my life, I didn't have to pretend anymore. I was connected. I could talk to them. I felt like I was a part of. And it was a tremendous thing for a guy who lived in the loneliness of untreated alcoholism for 12 years of my life. Because I think I was born with this spiritual malady called alcoholism. And alcoholism, being born with alcoholism, is like, it's kind of like going through life with a stone in your shoe. And every once in a while, you take that shoe off and you look inside and you shake it out and you rub it and you can't get nothing out of it. You put it back on and you're walking and there it is again. It's just that mild irritation, something just kind of gnawing at you. And no matter what you do, you can't seem to get that stone out of your shoe. And I live with that, it's like a hole inside of me. It's something was missing. And the only thing I ever found that really filled that hole up was alcohol in the early days of my drinking. And the problem with alcoholism, it's a twofold, it's a spiritual malady, but it's also a twofold disease. It's a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And the mental obsession started the moment I found the thing that did for me what I needed to have done. And then the physical allergies, what kept destroying me over and over and over again. I'm the guy they talk about in the big book. Dr. Silkworth says guys like me have this physical allergy. And unlike a lot of other allergies, when I take a drink of alcohol, I don't break out in hives or a rash. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. Now, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to my first meeting in 1971. I was a young kid. I was in an institution. And I didn't know why I was here. And from the years 1971 to 1978, I was in and out of institutions, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And many times through those years, I would hear people talk about the phenomenon of craving. And I would sit and try to examine myself and think to myself, well, I don't have a craving when I drink. I mean, I saw Days of Wine and Roses and The Lost Weekend. I mean, I'm not like that. I mean, I don't take a drink and claw the walls to get it. You know, I'm not like that. But the funny thing about a craving is that you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. Everybody in this room right at this moment is in the grip of a craving that you're not aware of. And that's the craving to breathe air. But if somebody were to sneak up behind you and put a plastic bag over your head, within a few seconds, you're going to realize that you've had this craving to breathe air all this time. You weren't even conscious of it. That's why there's a test in the big book in chapter 3. It says, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. Now, I don't recommend that test. Some of you guys wouldn't survive it. But I had to look back through my own life and find a time when my drinking was interrupted. And I did it by sitting in a meeting listening to some woman share her experience, and she reminded me of something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. And when I was 18 years old, in my mind, there was no way I was an alcoholic. Because when I was 18 years old, I wasn't really drinking alcohol per se that much. I was in my hippie stage, better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism, right? And I was dating a gal, and I guess it must have been kind of serious. I don't know. She invited me over to her house to meet her parents, one of those have dinner all night deals, right? And I went. I don't like stuff like that, but I went. And they had a bottle of wine with dinner, and I always drank quickly. I don't know, evaporation might be a serious issue with me or something. I don't know. But because I drank quickly, I finished two glasses out of that bottle of wine, and everybody's still sipping on their first glass, and the bottle of wine's empty. And I'm sitting there, and I got two glasses of wine in me, and I said to him, boy, it sure is good wine. You got any more? And they said, nope, don't have any more. Went back to talking. I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to get real uncomfortable. Now, I don't know anything about alcoholism, don't know anything about physical allergy, mental obsession. I don't know anything about craving. I don't know anything about anything. I'm just sitting there, and I'm getting real, my head's getting busy. The way you talk to yourself and your head's getting, it's going faster and faster, all this crazy stuff. I feel real antsy. I don't know what's going on. I blurted out, I said, you know, I like beer. And they said, well, that's nice, but we don't have any beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this other kind of stuff. And here I've got these two glasses of wine in me, and I'm going out of my mind. And I finally blurted out, I said, you know, I've learned to enjoy a nice cocktail with dinner. And I said, well, Bob, we don't have anything at all. We didn't know. Next time you come over, we'll have a six-pack of beer for you, whatever you want. We're sorry we didn't know. And they went back to talking. And I'm sitting in this dinner table, and I felt trapped. I felt like the walls are closing in on me. And I'm going crazy, and I got two glasses of wine in me. I don't know what's going on. So I excused myself from the dinner table. I went to the bathroom, and I locked the door. And like a crazed animal, I went through all the cabinets in there until I found a bottle of cough medicine. It was 35% alcohol with codeine and terpenhydrate. I opened it up, I took a big hit off of it, and there was hope. And I chugged that bottle of cough medicine down, and all of a sudden I got real focused, and I could think. And I came up with a story, and I went back out to that dinner table, and I was very gracious and apologetic, and I told him, I said, I'm so sorry, I forgot to take care of this certain thing, and I must leave, and I really hate to go, we must do this again. And they were very nice about it. You must come back, yes, yes. And I went and got in my car, drove like a gentleman, 20, 25 miles an hour down to the corner, and then I drove like 90 miles an hour like a maniac through this suburban area to get to a guy's house who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. Now, I was the only alcoholic at that dinner table. If those other people would have been alcoholics, we'd all been in that goddamn bathroom going through those cabinets. But something happens to me when I take a drink of alcohol that doesn't happen to normal people. And I don't think I really understood that until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous over 4 years. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous knowing and giving, surrendering to the fact that I couldn't take a drink. But I had this phenomenon of craving, but I secretly suspected that everyone who drank, they started to get the buzz from drinking, got that feeling like more, like that I always had. And Silkworth in our book says that's not true. He says people like us are the only ones that ever get that. He says that this phenomenon of craving differentiates us and sets us apart as a class. Normal people never experience that. And I was four and a half years sober, and I finally understood that. I was dating a gal that wasn't an alcoholic. And we would go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink. And I swear to God, it would take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, she would take a sip, talk for 10 minutes, stir it, the ice would melt. I mean, it's like alcohol abuse, you know what I mean? Right? And she, the whole time I knew her, I never saw her finish two complete drinks. I would see her often order a second drink, drink a third of it, fourth of it, half of it, two-thirds of it, and she would push it aside and say the most incredible thing you've ever heard. She'd say, I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it. It would be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, I don't want any more of that. I'm starting to feel it, than it would be to do that with two drinks of alcohol. And I started to understand that I am really different from those people. See, my friend, when she pushed aside the second drink, she was not trying to prove a point to me. We were all capable of that. If your spouse is on your back about your drinking, you can go out to dinner and you can have two to show her. If you're out to lunch with your boss and he's on your back about your drinking, you can have two to show him. Takes an effort of will, but we've all probably done that, most of us. But my friend's not trying to prove anything to me. When she takes two drinks of alcohol, she gets a feeling like she's losing control. I take two drinks of alcohol, I get a feeling like I'm getting control. It shapes my world up. It does something to me that opens up a black hole inside of me that I can never satiate. I have never once in my life ever drank. People told me I drank too much all my life. I have never drank enough. I have never once in a bar been in the drinking and said to the bartender, whoa, don't bring that next one. This is just right. This is just right. I don't need that. This is fine. I have never been there. I don't understand being there. One drink of alcohol opened that gate inside of me to more and more and more. And the only time I stopped was when I ran out of, I had to be stopped. I had to run out of money. I had to be 86th. I had to be arrested. I had to pass out, which was my frequent way of stopping drinking, was to drink until I passed out. I was a pass out drinker. That's when I knew I was done drinking. I was unconscious. Now, if that was the whole deal with alcoholism, I might have gotten sober in the early 70s. God knows I needed sobriety. Because there came, maybe not when I first, probably not when I went to my first few meetings in the early 70s, but by the mid 70s and the late 77, 76, 75 even, I got to a point where the progressiveness of this disease was overwhelming. And I had started to lose everything around me. And I was one of those guys that I was blessed to go all the way out to. I lived homeless on the streets without a roof over my head for a couple years. I was one of those guys that you see that panhandles nickels and dimes on the streets with the hair down to here that hadn't bathed in weeks. And I, in and out of Salvation Armies and Hope Rescue Missions, and I did all that stuff. You know, that sounds real dramatic, but I got to tell you a secret. It's better once you get there. You know what's really hard is when you're still trying to maintain a family relationship and jobs and stuff. Once you've drank all that away, it's like, thank God that's over with. Now I can drink. It's almost a relief. It's not. It's really not as bad as it sounds. It sounds real dramatic from the podium that I was homeless, but it's actually a kind of a relief to be there. No responsibilities. Nobody's on my back about my drinking. I was totally alone. I'd hook up with little wino partners and share a bottle once with them, you know, occasionally, and that was it. And I, but it got, what really started getting progressively worse was the inside stuff. And as my alcoholism is a disease of diminishing returns, in the beginning of my drinking, it was a tremendous effect on me. And a whole lot of fun and a little bit of problems and a little bit of pain. And as the years went on, the scales tipped and the effect diminished and the fun diminished and the problems grew and the problems got worse and the pain got greater. And as the years progressed and the disease progressed in me, I progressed away from the good times and the pain got greater and greater and greater. Until the last couple years of my drinking, there was really no fun left in it at all. I think, and I believe this with everything in me, that I think alcohol is possibly, for some of us, the most immediate and effective treatment for alcoholism we've ever found. And I got to tell you something, if alcohol still worked for me the way it worked for me when I was 18 years old, I would probably still drink it and pay the price of homelessness and losing everything in my life. What brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous is that alcohol, as the scale started to tip, it was no longer a good deal. And it stopped being an effective treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism. And when I say a treatment, I'll give you, you've probably had the same experiences that I am. I think alcoholism is a disease of separation and a disease of loneliness. And I can remember times in my life, I remember one time, I was probably in 10th grade, and I went to this party. And it was some people in 10th grade, most of the people were in 11th and 12th grade, a little older than I am. I remember walking into this house where the party was, and over in this one room is a bunch of kids dancing. Over here, there's a bunch of kids sitting on these couches making out. In the kitchen, there's a bunch of guys that are laughing and carrying on, and everybody there is having fun except me. And I get that feeling it's all of them really having a good time, and then there's me. And if you've ever been there, that's a sick, sick, lonely feeling. And I walked through most of my life with that sick, sick, lonely feeling of not fitting. And I remember walking around that party until I got to the corner where there was a card table with a bottle of 151 rum and a couple six-packs of Coca-Cola and some glasses. And I poured myself a big half-and-half thing of Coca-Cola and 151 rum. And within 10 or 15 minutes, I got a girlfriend. I'm dancing, I've met new guys, I'm telling jokes, I'm connected, I got lifelong friends. I feel like they look. I feel as much a part and as whole as anyone in that room. And at that time in my life, alcohol was an immediate and most effective treatment for the inside emptiness of alcoholism, this spiritual malady that I was born with. It did for me what I desperately needed to have done because I just didn't fit nowhere. Now, what happened to me is the scales tipped over the years and it stopped working. It got to a point where I'd be sitting in some Skid Row bar and I'm drinking and I'm not the guy that's having a good time anymore. I'm not the guy that's down by the pool table laughing and shooting pool and talking to the girls and telling jokes. I'm the guy that's sitting down at the end of the bar, drinking himself into oblivion, crying in his beer because I don't know what's wrong with me. And I feel so sick inside. And I look out at everybody else in the bar that's laughing and carrying on. And it breaks my heart because I hunger for what they're getting because they're obviously still getting the effects from alcohol that I used to get. And I can't get that no more. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I started imagining things were wrong. I remember one time thinking, I read in some book sometime somewhere about the seven warning signs of cancer, and I kind of sort of met a couple of them a little bit. You know, I was throw up blood once in a while, and I thought, geez, that's it. And I could kind of, if I sat and thought about it, I could kind of feel a brain tumor kind of growing in my head, you know. So, can imagine, it would explain a lot. That's why I do things and don't remember them, you know. I could sort of fantasize about, you know, one of these days they'll come down and get me out of the park and they'll find out I'm dying of cancer and take me to the cancer ward. And I could imagine them notifying my family and maybe some of my ex-employers and girlfriends, and they'd all come running over to the hospital to beg my forgiveness, realizing how wrong they'd been about me. You're not a drunken bum. My God, you got a brain tumor. We didn't know, Bob. We didn't know. We're sorry. They'd beg my forgiveness, and I might forgive some of them, might not. I don't know. And I used to have those kind of things. I remember one time reading in this book. It was in a novel. It was one of the characters in the novel had syphilis. And it was in the advanced stages, and it went to his brain, and it started to make him crazy, and he would have these memory lapses, and he would get real withdrawn, and sometimes he'd just like be so distant from life, and then other times he'd go into rages. And I read that, and I thought, that's it. I got syphilis. It went to my brain. That's it. I ended up in some Skid Row detox not too long after that. I remember doing an intake, and there's this doctor or somebody there, male nurse or somebody. He's talking to me, and he says, you obviously are an alcoholic. I said, well, I don't know about that, but I think my real problem is that I got syphilis, and it's gone to my brain. And he looked at me. He says, well, you may have that too, but we're pretty sure you have alcoholism. You sure to fit the description here. And I didn't have syphilis. I did blood tests to accommodate me. I didn't have syphilis. I have alcoholism. And I was always looking to see, because it never made sense. I would go to the AA meetings, and people in AA are telling me that my problem is drinking, but I would sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as sober as a judge. And I become so painfully aware that there's something else wrong with me. Because I don't feel the way anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous appears to feel. It seemed to me that you people were people who quit drinking and became happy about everything. You quit drinking and it seemed like every speaker was more grateful than the people who spoke before him. I mean, it was, and you loved everyone, and you laughed a lot, and you just had these success stories where, you know, it's like, oh, 6 months ago I was living in a dumpster, and through God and these wonderful AA 12 steps, I'm now the president of United States Steel, or, you know, all these stories, right? And here I sit, I'm sitting in the middle of a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. And I know what it's like to sit in AA rooms and die of alcoholism, because I don't have no program of recovery. I haven't worked any steps out of no book. I don't have no sponsor. I haven't done a four-step as it's outlined in the book. I haven't made no restitution. I'm not thinking about anybody except myself. I'm not sponsoring anybody, doing any service, or going on any 12-step calls. I'm just taking up a chair. And I think I'm part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm part of the passing parade that goes through AA on its way to the graveyard. Sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous does not make me a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sitting in a PTA meeting doesn't make you a parent. But I don't see that. All I see is that it seems to me I'm doing what you're doing and I'm not like you. See, one of my problems is that every time I stop drinking is really where my alcoholism really starts, where the bottle ends. And it's the emptiness of my own abstinence that drives me so insane. It drives me so insane that I will pick up something that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is going to destroy me, and I'll pick it up anyway. They used to say back in Pennsylvania, we just think the drink through. Well, I know what it's like to think it through and drink it anyway. I just get it up to here with being sober. A feeling would come over me that if I don't do something to change the way I feel, I'm going to lose my mind. And not all the time did I pick up a drink. Sometimes I would suffer from depression and go to a psychiatrist and he'd put me on pills. What's the difference, really? What I'm suffering from is alcoholism. I'm suffering from what happens to a guy like me when I go into a state of abstinence. And it's a deadly, deadly disease. And, you know, I just watched a close friend of mine with 15 and a half years of sobriety. I just went into an intensive care ward about 2 months ago and watched this guy strapped down. He was in intensive care because his vitals were so erratic they thought he was going to die. And it all started. He never picked up a drink. He went to it. And this guy wasn't a drug addict. He never did pills in his whole life. But at 15 years, almost 15 years of sobriety, he stopped working the steps. He wasn't sponsoring anybody. He wasn't going on any 12-step calls. And he got depressed and went to a doctor who put him on medication. And the phenomenon of craving eventually caught up with him. It took about almost a year. And it just snowballed into something that was so out of line that here he is, strapped down in intensive care, sobbing uncontrollably, wanting to die. And I saw this guy 15 and a half years ago when he was in detox, and talk about the progressiveness of this disease. He wasn't that bad then. And this is like so much worse. The guy I saw in that bed not too long ago and the guy I saw in that bed 15 and a half years ago, the one guy 15 and a half years ago looked well compared to the guy I saw a couple months ago. And he'd only been on those pills for a short period of time. Now, you might call that a lot of things. I think that's alcoholism. So my problem really started where the bottle ended. And I didn't understand what was going on here. Every time I'd stop drinking, sobriety to me feels like I'm doing time. And I'll tell you what happened to me in 1977. I was living in this halfway house, and I couldn't stay sober. I wanted to. I just couldn't. And me and this guy that were in there, we both busted out of there, and he had a little trailer, this little rundown trailer park, and he let me sleep on the couch in there. I started drinking with him, and we went out one night, a couple nights after we left the halfway house, and we were out drinking, and we came back to his trailer, and he passed out, and we ran out of beer. And I ain't passed out, and if I ain't passed out, I ain't done drinking. And he left his car keys and his wallet on the counter, which is a bad move for him. So I made a little loan, just going to pay it back, and took his car keys to go out and get some beer. And I got in a felony hit and run DUI in a stolen car, which they didn't believe me when I said I borrowed it. No registration, no insurance, no driver's license. I was put in the county jail. I stayed there for several months because I couldn't make bail, because homeless people can't make bail. You usually have to have an address to get out on bail. And I stayed there until it was time to go to court. And I went before a judge. And the judge called me up in front of him, and he said, we've went over your probation, the PO report here, and... sign these papers, it's a done deal. If you can, the probation department says there's only one place left in this part of the country that they'll take you. You've been in all the rehabs. They don't want you. You have one shot left, and you go into this place called the Ark House, and it wasn't really a rehab. It was more like a mission. They housed about 200 to 300 homeless winos down on Skid Row in Pittsburgh. And he said, you go in there and you stay in there for 1 year, and you do get good UAs, you get a good PO report, you make the restitution, the court costs, all that stuff. You come back in front of me with all good reports at the end of the 1 year, and maybe this will go away. But if you cannot fulfill any of those requirements, I've already signed the papers, it's a done deal, you're doing the 2 years. You don't even have to come back here. So I went into this place, and I went into this place with a determination never to pick up drinks, a drink again. I don't want to go through 2 years in prison. I've been on the inside. I don't jail well. I don't like it. It's not my kind of place. And besides, winter's coming on, and I'm afraid of freezing to death on the streets of Pittsburgh. I spent some time homeless back there, back on the East Coast, and it's a tough thing to do. If you're not in a halfway house, or if you're not in some kind of Salvation Army or mission program, it's a tough way, because you got to walk all night long. When it's 5 degrees out, you can't even sit down, because if you sit down, you're going to fall asleep. And if you fall asleep and it's 5 degrees out, you're dead. So you walk, no matter how sick you are, no matter how bad you need a drink, no matter how much you're shaken, you got to make yourself walk all night long looking for doorways that are warm and things like that. I just didn't want to do that no more. And I knew that if I pick up a drink, I'm going to do that until the police catch me, and then I go do 2 years if I don't freeze to death first. So I'm in this halfway house, and I'm determined with everything in me not to pick up a drink. And I got to tell you, if enthusiasm or determination or willpower were enough to overcome alcoholism, I'd have gotten sober years before. But I'm the guy they talk about in the big book when it says lack of power is my dilemma. I can make up my mind with everything in me never to pick up a drink. And the problem is I can't carry it out. I can intend to carry it out, but my willpower seems to dissipate, and it becomes like smoke in the wind. And eventually what happens, and it talks about this in the book, it says there comes a time when we have a seeming inability to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We were without defense against the first drink. And the further I got away from my last drink, the vaguer and the hazier the remembrance of that pain was, and my determination to stay off that alcohol became vague and hazy and started to fade. And as it became hazy and vague, the acuteness of my untreated alcoholism and the emptiness I lived with became sharper and more intense. And eventually I would start out with real solid weight of not drinking, a little bit of an urge to, and the scales would start to tip. And eventually one day, the day would come where I couldn't stand sobriety anymore and the emptiness of abstinence, and I would have to pick up a drink. And when that time came, no matter how much I tried to rethink it through, I couldn't grab on to the memory of that pain with any kind of impact. I don't think that that's a trait that's just true with alcoholics. I think that's a human thing. I think if that weren't true, most women would not have a second child if they could really fully remember the pain of childbirth at depth. I don't know that they would do it again. And I don't know that if we could remember what it felt like to come off our last drunk, I would ever pick up another drink. But see, when I'm empty and I don't fit anywhere and I'm lonely and isolated and detached and disconnected, I don't remember the pain. I remember when alcohol worked. And I remember the good times, because I hunger for them with everything in me. And my mind needs that, so it can only focus in that direction, and I can't control that. I have never once, on my way to a liquor store after any period of abstinence, stopped and thought about the pain. I was like a dog panting, waiting for the effects that I'd thinking it's going to be like it was when I was 18 years old. And it never was. And what brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978 is that I finally knew the truth. I finally knew that alcohol was stopped being an effective treatment for alcoholism. And I ended up drinking in that halfway house, and I couldn't stay sober, and I went on the run, and I'm
running from the law, and I'm hitchhiking, trying to get to California, and I ended up in Las Vegas in a detox in a county hospital. And there were my sponsor and members of a group called the Floating Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. They do a lot of 12-step work in Las Vegas. They probably do 90% of all the hospital and institution work there. And they brought meetings into that hospital detox. And the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And my sponsor and members of this group would come over to that hospital several times a week. And when I got out of there, I started following them around. I was just ready. And I was ready because I knew the truth. I knew that the party was over. And what brought me to that point of surrender, where I was willing to do some things that were against my judgment and follow some directions, was not the homelessness and the fear of prison. It was not the shame and the guilt. It was none of that stuff. What brought me to that point is that I finally knew that I was stuck. Sobriety was unbearable, and drinking was unbearable, and there's nowhere to go. I could not drink effectively and have fun doing that anymore, and yet I can't stay away from it. I love W.C. Fields. He says, I was sober one time. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my life, right? And I felt stuck. When you can't live sober and you can't live drunk, there ain't nowhere to go. And I started to do what these guys told me to do. And I was so fortunate to have fallen into the hands of a group of people that were thoroughly enmeshed in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't believe in anything else except this book. And they started me on a process that's outlined in this book, and it started to change my life. And I could spend some time talking about that process, and I'll touch on a couple things. When I got sober, I didn't believe in God. But there's a line in the book before we agnostics. It's a solution. It says, before we ever come to believe in God, we first come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we had been living it. And I could believe in that. And I believed in I was stuck. And so when my sponsor said to me, I want you to get down on your knees every morning and ask whoever is running the universe for help, and get down on your knees at night and thank that power, I just started doing it. And I didn't believe in God. I kind of felt like a hypocrite. I remember in the halfway house, I would go in the bathroom and close the door and pull the drapes over the window and make sure nobody put a towel underneath the door in case somebody was laying down there trying to peek. So I'd get down on my knees. You know, I didn't want anybody to see me, right? But I started doing it, and I felt stupid doing it because I thought, like, I'm just saying these words to the air. And the most incredible thing started to happen. As a result of acting as if there was a power greater than myself in my life, I started to experience an endless series of coincidences. And I can't tell you how many hundreds of times in my first couple years of sobriety, and even still today, but I think it had more impact then when it was new, that I would sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd be all jammed up and I'd be just nuts and feeling awful. And I don't have the presence of mind to understand what I'm feeling or to even understand what's going on, let alone know which way to go with it. And I don't even understand it well enough to tell my sponsor what's going on. I'm just all jumbled up and just felt terrible. And I'd be sitting there in the meeting and some stranger in the meeting would start sharing exactly about what's going on with me. And it would blow my mind. And first of all, I would know I'm not alone. And I would know that all of a sudden I could see clearly through his eyes what's going on with me. And through him also, I would find my solution of what action was necessary to take. And that didn't happen to me once or twice. That happened to me over and over and over and over again. And I started to come to believe the only way a guy like me could ever come to believe that there was something here, some kind of power that's working in my life. And I didn't understand what it was, but I knew, I started to become convinced by the reality of my experience that there was something here going on. And it's kind of like the story of the lamplighter. They're over in England, around the turn of the century, the streets of London were lit by gas lamps. And there was a guy that at dusk, he would go around and he would, with a long pole with a flame on it, he'd light the gas lamps of the street of London. He was called a lamplighter. And you could go up to the top of the Tower of London at twilight and look out over the city, and no matter how hard you looked, you couldn't see where the lamplighter was. But you could see where he'd been. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2.5 and 3 years sober, and I couldn't see where God was. But let me tell you something, I could see where he'd been. Not only could I see where he'd been in my life, but more clearly is that I could really see where he'd been in the guys that came sober 6 months after I did, out of Samaritan House and Starting Point, the Skid Row detoxes in Las Vegas, and the Salvation Army, and I could see how their life had changed. And within 2 years, they're back with their families. They're working. They're paying taxes. They got a sparkle in their eyes. They're useful, productive members of society. And you can't get from where they were to where they're at. It would take a miracle. And I think I could see God working in you before I could even see him working in me. I belong to a group that's entrenched in service in AA. We do 10 hospital and institution meetings every week. I sponsor a lot of guys. I'm responsible for 3 of those meetings every week. If you're ever in Las Vegas on a Monday, a Tuesday, or a Thursday, I'd be glad to take you to one of the halfway houses or one of the detoxes where I secretary a meeting. And I do that because it is the essence of my sobriety. I believe with everything in me that my sobriety is absolutely worthless unless I'm trying to give it to somebody else. It is meaningless. And I've seen something in these Skid Row detoxes that most people, unless you do a lot of H&I work, will never see in Alcoholics Anonymous. I see the guys that were sober 15, 20, 25 years that drink again. And the reason we never see them in mainstream AA is they never get this far back into Alcoholics Anonymous. They die going in and out of Skid Row detoxes and Hope Rescue Missions and Salvation Armies. They never make it back this far into AA as a member of a home group. And I got to tell you something. I've been doing these meetings for 19 years, and there's not a week that goes by that I don't see a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that's been sober a long time, that at one time had vital and active sobriety, that has drank again. And I always ask him the same thing. I always ask him, well, what was going on the couple weeks before you drank? And you know, you hear some people say, well, it must be that they didn't go to meetings. I've seen people that went to 8 meetings a week and still drank. Well, some people would say, well, their relationship with God's not right. I know a guy that did a third step, went out and killed himself the next day. But the one thing they all seem to have in common is if you ask them the question, when was the last time you sat down for 5 or 6 hours with a new guy that's coming off a drunk? When was the last time you were actively sponsoring someone and taking him through the steps? When was the last time you heard a fifth step? When was the last time you knew that your life was dedicated to trying to help another alcoholic? Most of them will say, you know, I'd stopped doing that 2 years before I drank. I did a lot of it years ago. This one guy was telling me, he says, when I was 10 years sober, I sponsored over 30 guys. And here at 18 years sober, he's dying of alcoholism. And he hadn't sponsored anyone for 3 years. And all the guys he did sponsor, they were going about their own business. Most of them had gotten new sponsors or they didn't call him anymore. And this one guy in my home group that drank at 18 and a half years, I got to tell you, he blew my mind because he was one of the guys that helped me a lot when I was new. And the day he drank, his life was picture perfect. He had 2 brand new cars, had a big house, had an agency that was probably producing him well over $200,000 a year. He had a wonderful marriage. And I asked him, I said, the day that you drank, was there anything bothering you? I mean, were you having a fight with your wife? Was the IRS on your back? I mean, there had to be something going on. And you know what he said to me? He says, Bob, he says, my life was never better. He says, I was at a Rotary luncheon like I've been to every week for years, and they serve cocktails there. And I've been there hundreds of times and never had a drink. And all of a sudden, the waitress came around with a tray, and I just said, yeah, I'll take one of those. He says, I don't even know where it came from. And I think what happens to guys like me, and it talks about this on page 20 of the big book. It says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon my constant thought of others, their needs, and how I can work for them. And I think what happened to my friend is that his life became wonderful as a result of practicing the principles of these steps. But he stopped doing the 12th step, and he stopped trying to help other alcoholics. And even though his life was rich and full and abundant, it was nothing except all about him. It was just all about him. And for people, if you believe, like I believe, what it says in this book, that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, I will die if my life is all about me, no matter how rich and abundant it may be, no matter how high my self-esteem is, no matter how great my relationships are with people, if my life is all about me, I'm a dead man. And I've seen this happen over and over and over. And it's a progression. It's a progressive disease in sobriety. I watch guys all the time. They come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Their first year of sobriety, it's like they really have a big case of alcoholism, so big that they go to a meeting every day. They pray every day. They talk to their sponsor every day. They go on 12-step calls. They're on committees. They're a secretary of a meeting. They're just doing everything they can possibly do. They're acting as if they really have alcoholism. It's a fatal disease, and if they don't do something, they're going to die. At 3 years sober, they're going to about 3 meetings a week. They call their sponsor once a week. They shook a hand of a newcomer about a week ago somewhere. And they're moving from a lot of alcoholism into not quite so much alcoholism. And then at 8 years, it's, well, I go to a meeting once a week, and I don't really have time. I got this. I'm involved in this church and the Rotary, and I'm involved with my marriage. I don't really have time to work with newcomers or just give a guy a ride to a meeting. And besides, I did all that my first few years. And what happens is that we progress in the disease of alcoholism into alcoholism. And there's a line in the big book that says the idea that we are like other people, that means non-alcoholic people, the idea that we are like them or presently may be like them has to be smashed. And I've watched people over the years, people I've loved, they start moving from alcoholic to non-alcoholic as if they no longer have alcoholism. And then when they pick up a drink, they're surprised. Dr. Silkworth wrote an article in The Grapevine a few years ago about relapse, and he put it better than I ever heard it. He said, relapse from alcoholism is a lot like heart disease. If you have a heart attack and you go to the hospital and they said, you know, you almost died, but you can live another 20 years providing you do certain things. You got to lay off these certain foods and salt, et cetera, et cetera. We want you to walk every day. You got to take this medicine. They're going to give you a regimen to live by. And if you do all those things, you'll live a normal lifespan. And you get out of the hospital and you're doing all those things and it's great and you feel wonderful. And your life is, you feel like you have no problem at all. And then one day you're out to eat somewhere and boy, the person with you orders something that you shouldn't have it, but boy, you really like it. You know what I mean? It's just, you haven't had it for a long time. And you order it, you eat it, and you know what happens? Nothing. So next week you have it again. And then you start thinking, man, I feel great. And I don't have to walk anymore. And pass the salt, will you? And 6 months later, you're back in the cardiac unit wondering what happened and how like alcoholism that is. That if I stop treating this disease and I start acting like I don't have it anymore, then the same thing is going to happen to me that happens to other people. And my ego would like to tell me that I'm superior, that what can happen to you can't happen to me, but that's a bunch of crap. If I have the same disease that you have, what can happen to you can happen to me. I am not bulletproof. I'm not immune from alcoholism. I have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I try to stay real current in my life with Alcoholics Anonymous. I work with the guys that I sponsor pretty closely. Seems like I always got somebody that's going through a fifth step. And I got to tell you, sometimes it bugs me. Like this weekend, the last 3 days, I've had to speak in 3 different nights in 3 different cities. I got to go back to Las Vegas Monday night and do a step workshop, and Tuesday night do a detox meeting and a step workshop at my house. And sometimes I just feel like, enough. Why doesn't somebody else do this stuff? And yet I call my sponsor up and he's doing more than I'm doing. You know, he tells me about all the places he's going, and the reality is the result of my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous and my trying to give this thing away, my life is richer than it's ever been. And there's a principle in AA that doesn't make any sense, but it has been the reality of my life the last 19 years, is that I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I've washed up. I'm no good for nothing. So I give up. And I turn myself over to God, and I try, and as I said in the third step prayer, to make my life none of my business. I said, God, I offer myself to you for you to build with me and you to do with me as you will. I'm out of the loop. And if I try to leave myself alone and help God's kids, while I'm doing that, God seems to do for me what I cannot do for myself. And the most amazing thing about recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is in direct proportion to how much service I do for others is my life improve and get richer. And the problem is that I know I don't deserve the life I got. Not really. So as God gives this abundance to me, I owe. And because I owe, I got to do more service. And the problem with doing more service is that then I get more good stuff that comes to me. So now I owe more. Right, so I got to do more service. And the more service I do, the more I owe. It's like God's the worst loan shark in the universe. I mean, I'm never going to get out of this thing alive. And it's through trying to help other people that I'm relieved of the bondage of self. And if you're sitting in this room and you've never sponsored anyone or gone on a 12-step call and you never have had the experience when after sitting with a guy for 2 or 3 hours, something deep down inside of you reaches out and touches some kind of spot of pain inside of him. And at that moment, you feel more connected and more vital and more whole than you've ever felt. A very similar feeling to when you were a young kid and you just had 5 shots of Jack Daniels. And you feel good about yourself, good about this life, and you know that you're in the right place doing the right thing. If you've never had that experience, look forward to it. It is the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous to me is not a self-help program. It is a program of self-abandonment. Either God is everything or he is nothing. I am either here to help his kids or I'm here to help myself. And if I'm here to help myself, all I'm going to get is more alcoholism, because that's the nature of this disease. And just to the extent that I'm here for you, does my life seem to get better? And that is the only relief I have, because I'm the guy they talk about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our trouble. I think underneath everything, I'm basically self-obsessed. And self-obsessed, internally focused, self-absorbed people like me never really fit in this world, because we're not in this world. I'm in this one. I'm a deep thinker. And there's a lot of deep thinkers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the problem with that is that alcohol at one time relieved me of the bondage of self. 5 shots of tequila and I could come out and play. I could get out of here and really be here with you and honestly care about you. And somehow through the process of these 12 steps do I duplicate the effects I'd found in alcohol. When I have a moment when I'm sitting with some new guy and maybe I've had a day where I've been full of fear and things at work are scaring me and I don't know what's going on and it seems like life is out of control. And after an hour or 2 hours sitting with a guy listening to a fifth step or just a guy coming off a drunk, something happens inside of me that turns around my whole perspective of life, and all of a sudden everything is right. And there's a rightness about me and there's a rightness about this world. And only alcohol ever did that to me prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you a quick story, and then I'm going to shut up. I always share this. It's a story of the last 19 years of my life. It's a Sunday afternoon, the guy's got the day off. He's sitting in his easy chair reading the newspaper. He's got a six-year-old daughter, and she comes up. She says, "Daddy, please play with me." He says, "Oh, not now, sweetheart. I'm reading the paper." And she says, "Daddy, please play with me." And he looks in the paper, and there's an ad for an airlines. It's a full-page map of the world showing where the planes fly. He gets an idea. He tears it out of the newspaper. He tears up the map of the world, the little pieces. He grabs a roll of scotch tape. He says, "Sweetheart, here's a puzzle. Take this in your room. If you can put it together, bring it back, and I'll play with you for the rest of the day." And she takes off down the hall. He sits back in his chair. He figures he's off the hook. She's 6 years old. She don't have a shot. 10 minutes later, she brings it back, and it's taped together perfectly. And he goes, "My God, sweetheart, how did you do that?" And she says, "It was easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man. And when I put the man together, the world just kind of fell into place." And if you're new, I encourage you with everything in me to abandon yourself to this simple program. Find a sponsor who is entrenched in this book and is active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and do everything he tells you to do, and follow the people that have gone before you, and you will observe the most incredible miracle of your whole life. A world that you never seemed to really fit in unless you were half drunk. A world that seemed hostile and alien to you will become the most incredible place you've ever lived. Thank you.